The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this ninth day of October 2019. We're ready for oral arguments in the first case on the calendar, State of Minnesota versus Michael Casillas. Is that pronounced correctly?
Casillas.
Casillas, pardon me. Each side will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and appellant will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Please introduce yourself for the record before you begin your argument, and you may approach the podium and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Archigo. I am here today on behalf of appellant Michael Casillas. Minnesota Statute 617.261 is an unconstitutional, overbroad, content-based restriction on speech that is not subject to a narrowing construction and does not survive strict scrutiny. For these reasons, this court must invalidate the section. The starting point in the court's analysis should be construing the plain language of the statute and determining whether the First Amendment is implicated. If we look at the plain language of the statute, it very clearly prohibits the dissemination of media, of photos, of videos. This has long been recognized as inherently expressive activity by not only the United States Supreme Court, but by our own state appellate courts. The distribution of photographs is inherently expressive activity. The plain language of the statute undoubtedly implicates the First Amendment.
Counsel, could I ask a question about your arguments? I see that you make both an overbreath argument and a content-based argument, and as I understand those theories, those are two independent grounds to mount a facial attack to the constitutional validity of a statute. So I understand the overbreath doctrine, it presumes that there is a constitutional application of the statute which can be had, but that the unconstitutional applications are substantial and therefore the whole statute fails. What in this case is the constitutional application of this statute?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know that there is one for this particular statute. The statute as it's written is extremely overbroad. I don't think that the way that it's written with the elements that it has laid out, there is no constitutional application of this statute. So we were simply highlighting the fact that the statute as a whole, as it's written, is entirely overbroad, and there is no constitutional application. It cannot be narrowly interpreted to apply to only reach some type of maybe unprotected speech.
So am I correct then to understand your position as being that this challenge is properly one that's based to brought as a content-based regulation of protected speech?
It is a content-based regulation of protected speech, Your Honor. It doesn't prohibit the dissemination of all photographs or all videos or all media in general. It quite clearly only prohibits a specific subset of images.
And why do you argue that the government cannot proscribe the conduct here consistent with the First Amendment?
The statute, Your Honor, is prohibiting speech. That's the issue, is that it cannot prohibit the speech that it's...
But why is it too broad? Why is the statute too broad? Or why does it fail strict scrutiny?
It fails strict scrutiny, Your Honor. There's two separate issues there.
Let me ask, why does it fail strict scrutiny? And I appreciate that in the case law, the overbreath concept and the content-based strict scrutiny content sometimes get conflated, and we'll have a content-based challenge where they start talking about whether it's overbroad. So maybe it's best that we just focus on the content-based language and ask, why does the statute fail strict scrutiny as a content-based regulation?
In order to survive strict scrutiny, the government needs to identify a compelling interest, a compelling state interest that needs to be remedied, and that in this case perhaps can violate certain aspects of protected speech, has to be narrowly drawn, has to be the least restrictive means to accomplish that goal.
Well, let me ask you this. As I understand the state's brief, its position is the compelling state interest is the prohibition of the dissemination of kind of private information without consent, and given the lack of consent and the type of information, the dissemination is akin to domestic abuse or sexual harassment.
That's the respondent's position.
Would you agree that that's a compelling government state interest to prevent that sort of dissemination?
It depends on the context, the application of it, I guess, and the law that is at issue in this case. We have a law that infringes on the First Amendment that implicates the First Amendment. So when we're looking at what is the compelling interest and whether the protection of personal individual privacy can be a compelling interest in First Amendment context, I think is the way that the issue needs to be analyzed.
Why is this, assuming for the sake of argument, that's the compelling state interest in this case, why is the statute not narrowly tailored to serve that interest?
Because that's not what the statute prohibits.
Okay.
Respondent advances arguments that sort of presume or reads in additional elements, makes arguments that essentially that the statute only prohibits substantial invasions of privacy where we have dissemination that was knowingly made. The actor knew that the content and character of the media that was being disseminated and knew that there wasn't consent to disseminate and knew that there was an expectation of privacy. Those are the way that the issue that the respondent has framed, it sort of makes the arguments with that understanding, but that's not the way that this law is written.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm tracking you, counsel, because when I look at section 17.261, subdivision 1, subdivisions 2 and 3, it talks about the actor knows or reasonably should have known that the person depicted in the image does not consent to the dissemination, and then the next one is that the person depicted had a reasonable expectation of privacy. So it seems to cover those two of lack of consent and invasion of privacy.
The statute imposes a negligence standard, Your Honor. It reaches conduct that that can be punished if the actor should have known that the subject did not consent, or that there should have known that there was an expectation of privacy. The statute may be a bit tighter, so to speak, if it required kind of what I call a double knowledge requirement, where the actor specifically knew that there was no consent to disseminate, and specifically knew that there was an expectation that the subject matter would remain private. But that's not what the statute says.
I'm not tracking you, though, because it does have those double knowledge requirements. The actor knows that there's no consent and that the image, that the person depicted had a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Your Honor,
quite following you there.
Yep.
Counsel, do you mean to say that if you took out the reason to know portion of each of those factors, it would be adequate?
I don't believe so, because it doesn't have any intent element, it doesn't have an intent to harm.
So I just want to back up, because I thought I just heard you say if the actor knew there was no consent and knew there was an expectation of privacy, that would fix the statute. You're saying that's not the case.
That's not the case. I said
okay.
It might be a bit tighter if it removed that language.
And what's the significance of the lack of an intent requirement?
Because
intent to what? What are we looking for?
Well, there's got to be some type of criminal intent to make this a crime, to punish criminal conduct or criminal speech, criminal expressive activity. The way that the statute's currently written, it punishes what I kind of call accidental dissemination, where you don't have to know the material that you're disseminating contains any type of nudity. It requires intentional dissemination. There's a difference between intentionally doing something and knowing what you're doing is a crime, especially when it comes into this context. There are a handful of other state statutes that address this issue, and instead of using intentional dissemination, it uses knowingly disseminated. So if we have an element of knowledge of what you're doing, and then coupled with an intent to cause some type of harm, and a lot of statutes have that intent element, I think it's something like 37 out of the 46 state statutes now require an intent to harm, and a lot of them also have coupled with that a reasonable person would experience harm or that actual harm was suffered. So it may be possible to reach this type of speech, of expressive activity, with some much more limiting language than what this statute has.
Why isn't the language, the intent language with respect to dissemination coupled with the knowledge with respect to privacy and consent, why isn't that enough?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I lost
it. Sure. You were talking about intent to harm.
Right.
And roughly 37 states, and there are at least three other courts, Texas, Vermont, and California, have issued opinions on this issue. And you were talking about intent to harm. And some statutes also talk about intent to harm and actual harm. Why isn't this statute with intent to disseminate coupled with the knowledge elements, why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, the statute doesn't have just definitive knowledge elements. It's sort of two part for each subdivision. It requires that the actor know or reasonably should know that the person depicted does not consent, and that the image was obtained or created in circumstances which the actor knew or reasonably should have known that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy.
If we were to sever the reasonably should have known phrases from the two subparts, such that the state had approved the actor, knew subject didn't consent, knew subject had a reasonable expectation of privacy, would that establish the necessary intent in all cases?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. I still take issue with the fact that the way that the statute's currently written doesn't require that the actor knew what they disseminated contained some type of even partial nudity. It requires intentional dissemination. So essentially where some of the examples that we gave in our brief, if I'm intentionally maybe distributing a photograph or posting a photo to social media, but I didn't realize in the photograph that there was a partially exposed female adult nipple, for
what
example.
If it's a circumstance where a person knows exactly what they're disseminating, knows there's not consent, and knows there's a reasonable expectation of privacy? Is that adequate intent?
That can be. I mean, those are sort of the elements that the other three state appellate courts that have addressed this issue, Vermont, California, and Texas, where they have pointed to those specific elements in their statute, where you have knowing dissemination, you have knowledge that there was no consent to make that dissemination, you have knowledge that there was privacy, and you also had an intent to harm and causation of harm. And now okay, you
so
have...
So they actually, it's more than just, I know there's nudity in the picture, I know the subject doesn't consent, I know the subject expected this to be private. What you're saying is the other states say, you also have to intend to harm by disseminating this. So if a person knows all those things and thinks, this is funny, it's a joke, and doesn't have an intent to harm, that's not a crime.
Well, then that becomes a factual issue. Yeah, at that point for prosecution.
I guess what I'm saying is there are arguably circumstances where even with knowledge of content, lack of consent, and expectation of privacy, you could still have arguments about whether or not there was intent to harm.
Of course, absolutely. And
so you can't infer necessarily intent to harm from the three knowledge requirements we've just described.
I don't believe so. No, I don't believe you can. And the reason being because the statute then would still sort of reach some of the issues, some of the examples that we cited in our brief. And specifically, what I refer to as the Charlie example that was pointed out in the Texas opinion, where somebody sends me a photograph and I sort of send that photograph off to whoever else or show it to somebody else. It still reaches sort of that behavior. And unless we're talking about a very specific sort of category of restricted speech, and this may be obscenity, but the statute doesn't even come close to satisfying what is required for obscenity. And when we're talking about the negligent language in this statute, the negligent knowledge language that's in this statute, we've had recent opinions from our state Supreme Court in State v. Hensel, and in AJB, where the court has specifically pointed to the problematic language. Anytime you have reason to know or reasonably should have known, there's such a widespread danger that it's going to reach so much non-criminal expressive activity or speech.
Counsel, if we presume then the statute as written, as you've argued, is an overreach, affects protected First Amendment speech, Why or what could you point to us that, because the next step is then it has to be substantially overbroad, not simply overbroad, but substantially overbroad as written, and including some of these limitations we've been talking about, would not that be a reasonable argument that while it might reach some hypothetical overbroad scenarios, it's not substantially? If you disagree with that, why?
Your Honor, I think I did highlight several examples in our brief that stands to be criminalized. That's not a crime. It's in order to sort of prohibit this nudity itself, Your Honor, is not distribution of nudity itself is not criminal. It's just not. It has to be obscene.
But isn't it true by the words of the statute that generally would not be a violation of the statute either, because it requires this some knowledge that the person does not want it to be disseminated.
It requires, I guess, a negligent standard that maybe you should have known the person didn't want it disseminated.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal. For the state.
May it please the court. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Dakota County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. Intentional, non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images. That is what is at issue before the court today. This is about an intentional act of violating someone else's privacy by exposing some of their most intimate moments to the public without consent. This is about privacy. This is a privacy regulation. It's about preserving one's dignity, preserving one's bodily autonomy, and making...
Counsel, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm going to because I have several questions about the state's argument in this mm-hmm. case. You make much of the privacy argument here. I've read a lot of First Amendment cases in the past week. I don't see that private information has been identified by the United States Supreme Court as a category of unprotected speech under the First Amendment. Do you have any authority that suggests it is, or that we would be within our rights to do so?
There's been suggestions that privacy matters and speech related to purely private matters is less deserving of First Amendment protection than speech on public matters.
The cases you've cited for that proposition have to do generally with serendipitous recordings, invading another person's privacy with harassing phone calls. So in other words, circumstances where the communication is imposed upon someone, as opposed to this case where it's a display of another person's private images. Do we have any First Amendment cases that say the privacy concern applies in this context, or would it just be by analogy?
It would primarily be by analogy, although I would point to the facts underlying in this case, although I know this is not an as-applied challenge. The facts in this case, the appellant hacked into the
victim's
account.
I understand the facts.
So it wasn't a communication on the part of the victim.
Right.
And so in this case, he was serendipitously gaining access to her personal information and then disseminating
But does the statute require that? This is a facial challenge. Is that required under the statute?
It is not.
As I understand the doctrines, you can make one of two challenges facially, a content-based challenge or an overbreadth challenge. If it's a content-based regulation, it's presumed unconstitutional. The burden is on the state to show that the statute survives strict scrutiny. If it's an overbreadth analysis, the burden is, I guess I'm not sure where the burden is, but it seems like it's a harder argument to make in terms of facial invalidity, because the court has to determine that the unconstitutional applications of the statute are substantial and warrant striking down the statute, as opposed to allowing those potentially unconstitutional applications to be considered in an as-applied context. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to first address the argument that this statute is facially unconstitutional as a content-based regulation. Do you think it's content-based?
I think there's an argument to be made, and why I included it in my brief is that I think there's arguments on both sides that this could be construed as a content-neutral regulation of speech because it does not proscribe all sexual or nude images with nudity. It only proscribes non-consensual dissemination of those images, and so it's not related to the content of the images.
My understanding from the case law of how one determines whether something is a content-based regulation is to ask, do I need to look at the content to know whether this communication violates the statute? And if the answer is yes, it's content-based. If, in fact, that is the test, would we be fair to conclude that this is content-based because it's based on certain sexual images?
It would be fair to conclude that, but I would just also remind that there is the non-consensual piece that must be established.
But the non-consensual piece, and this is sort of a theme I see within the state's brief, is turning to the circumstances of the dissemination as opposed to the content of the dissemination in making these First Amendment arguments. So, for example, as to obscenity, the definition of obscenity requires one to look at the content of the communication, whereas the state has sort of argued, well, if someone disseminates this content without consent, it's obscene. Well, that's focusing on the method of dissemination. And then,
sure.
So that's my concern when we talk about whether or not this is content-based. We only look at the content, not, well, it's content that was disseminated without consent. You're kind of going astray from the actual test.
And that's I've struggled in this case because this statute does not fit squarely within a First Amendment analysis, and that's why I've tried to highlight to the court the privacy considerations.
Understood. Well, let me ask you this. If, in fact, the state has a compelling state interest in preventing people from engaging in the type of dissemination that's the equivalent of abuse or harassment, is this statute narrowly tailored to serve that purpose? And what I'd like you to specifically address is the lack of intent to cause harm.
It is narrowly tailored to address the compelling government interest in this case. There is no need to include an intent to harm element. What is the actual harm that needs to be intended? These images are disseminated without consent for a variety of reasons. It can be to humiliate, it can be to coerce, it can be to manipulate, but it can also be for profit, it can be for notoriety.
Shouldn't the government, if the government's claim is that we need to criminalize this conduct because a person who is doing this intends to harass, defame, humiliate, abuse, shouldn't the government have to prove some such motive and intent?
I do not believe so. There needs to be an intentional dissemination.
Well, let me ask you the hard question then, because I've read a lot of cases. From this court and the Supreme Court within the past few years, specifically State versus AJB, Linnert versus McDonald, State versus Muccio, State versus Washington Davis, State versus Stockwell, Dunham versus Roer. Those are all cases in which a First Amendment challenge was mounted to a criminal statute. And generally speaking, the thing that those cases have in common is the court looked to the existence of a specific intent requirement in the statute or the absence of such a requirement in determining whether or not the statute could survive a First Amendment facial challenge. In cases where there was a specific intent requirement, and by specific intent, I mean specific intent to cause harm of some sort, the court said, this is okay. In cases where the statute lacked a specific intent requirement, the court said, this can't pass strict scrutiny or an overbreath challenge. So, I mean, the case law seems to really focus on whether or not the statute specifically punishes malicious intent, and if so, is willing to tolerate a First Amendment violation to the attendant communication. Otherwise not. So, I mean, with those cases in mind, could you tell us whether this statute has a comparable intent? So not just intent to disseminate, but intent to disseminate and thereby cause harm.
The intent is wrapped up in the multiple mens rea requirements that are already established in the statute. So the intentional dissemination coupled with the knowledge of non-consent and the knowledge of a reasonable expectation of privacy at the time.
So those things might suggest there's the intent. Here's my problem with that. What do we do with the enhancement provision that says if you disseminate with intent to harass, it's a felony as opposed to a gross misdemeanor? Does the existence of a harassment enhancement suggest that it's possible to violate this statute without having any intent to harass, in which case it's a gross misdemeanor? And is that sort of the dooming flaw of the statute?
No, it's not the dooming flaw of the statute, because there can be many intent reasons why someone would disseminate these images, and all of those reasons should still be criminalized. So intent to profit off the images, intent to gain notoriety, even just intent to entertain themselves by disseminating intimate photos of someone without their consent should be a crime, and that is what this statute is trying to get
at. But how does punishing intent to entertain serve the goal of preventing abuse or harassment?
Well, the compelling government interest, I would posit as being to protect privacy and the bodily autonomy of the person depicted in the image. Oftentimes, this is utilized as a form of abuse and sexual harassment, but that is not every case, and that does not impact the effect that it has on the victim and the harm that the legislature is trying to remedy through this statute.
What if one of the examples that I believe appellant cites, and it's an example that was persuasive with the Texas court, what if we're looking not at the person who originally disseminated the image, but somewhere two or three clicks down the line? Someone comes upon this image, shows up in their inbox, they resend it without knowing much about the circumstances.
Sure.
And is it possible a prosecutor would say, well, given that this is a topless woman in her bathroom, you should have known this is a private photo and you shouldn't have sent it out. You reasonably should have known she didn't consent. You reasonably should have known she expected it to be private. You're therefore guilty of a crime, even though you have no intent to harm anyone.
No, because the prosecutor would have to look, is there a reasonable knowledge here that they would have known?
We have plenty of appellate courts saying we're not going to trust the prosecutor to make good judgment. We need a statute that clearly delineates what is and isn't allowed.
And that's why the statute is very clear and precise on saying that you need to show that have a reason to know, which would need to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that there is an expectation of privacy in the photo.
But
is it not possible that
the circumstances I've just described, someone could make an argument. If we have a woman who's topless in her bathroom putting on makeup, obviously that looks like a private photo. Most reasonable people would assume that someone doesn't want that photo out there. So arguably the person who re-disseminates it know or should known and maybe could be subject to criminal prosecution.
I think we need to look at the context of how it was disseminated, where that person is getting the image from. If it looks like it's being sent to a lot of people and it's two or three people down the line, I would say that we wouldn't be able to see that there is a reasonable expectation in that photo anymore. And so I don't know if that
would
be
criminalized. Why? Because how would the fact that I'm the 10th recipient change whether or not the subject consented or the subject expected privacy? Because those disseminations are beyond the control of the subject. I don't understand how one
leads
to the other.
Because it's looking at the actor's knowledge of whether there was a reasonable expectation in the photo. So if the actor is the one
receiving the image, they
wouldn't have any way to know that it wasn't disseminated with consent.
But might that person think, there's a chance I could be charged with a crime if somebody thinks I should know this, therefore I'm not going to re-disseminate?
Possibly, but I don't think that would meet the element of the crime in the statute.
Right, but would that be a chilling effect that should concern us in a First Amendment context?
I do not believe so. If I could just also, since this is stemming from the Texas court, I do want to point out to this court that another case from Texas, Ex Parte Lopez, is another case from the Texas Intermediate Court of Appeals that upheld this law as narrowly tailored. And so Ex Parte Jones that the appellate relies on is at the Supreme Court of Texas right now. And so there is no
Is the Lopez case, though, one in which there is specific intent?
No. The statute requires that harm is caused, but there is no intent to harm.
But it requires harm. This statute doesn't require harm.
Correct, but...
And I don't mean to say that flippantly. I simply note that in the Minnesota case law, generally they're looking at intent to harm, but there's also a couple of other cases that say, or actual harm results. So that sort of is, again, that thing that pulls it out of the First Amendment context.
I appreciate
the state's argument. I'm not in any way suggesting that this is appropriate conduct that we're dealing with in this case. It's abhorrent, but we have some pretty strong First Amendment concerns in case law that call into question the validity of these statutes, and that's why I'm trying to explore this as best we can in our limited time.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that it doesn't nicely fit the First Amendment cases where we normally go, well, this is mailing letters or picketing, the things that are traditionally recognized as appropriate First Amendment exercises. Do you agree, though, that... the dissemination of a photo is a form of communication. You know, whether or not the content falls in protected speech or not, we are dealing with communication here.
Yes, it is expressive conduct. I see that we are running out of time. I do want to remind the court that the power to declare a statute unconstitutional should be used only in extreme cases and with utilizing extreme caution for the reasons, and I'll rely on my brief for remaining arguments.
And I have asked you a lot of questions. If you want another minute or two to sum up, I'll give you that. It's an important case.
Sure. If the court will grant me, just to talk about the analysis that the state is asking the court to proceed on. We jumped to content-based and strict scrutiny. If you look at particularly the Muccio case, the Supreme Court went through the overbreath analysis and at the end of that analysis found that it was not substantially overbroad and then ended the analysis there, did not go on to address strict scrutiny. So I would ask this court to look at obscenity and whether... this statute regulates obscenity and anything outside of obscenity or privacy regulations is not substantially overbroad and conclude that the statute is constitutional on that basis. And then if it deems it necessary to go on to strict scrutiny to find that the statute is narrowly tailored to the compelling government interest. In this case, we ask that this court uphold the constitutionality of 617.261 and affirm the appellant's conviction and sentence. If there aren't any additional questions.
Questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Anna. Just like to touch on a couple kind of points briefly. Certainly if the court has any additional questions. I think Your Honor has highlighted the issues that are in play in this matter. The statute as it's written is not a privacy regulation. I believe respondent just acknowledged that it does implicate the First Amendment. That's our starting point here. I don't believe that respondent advanced any case law to support its position that somehow there's some type of privacy interest at play that allows a restriction or a prohibition on speech. In terms of whether the statute's content-based or not, again, Your Honor is correct. You have to look at the content of the matter to sort of answer that question. And to get back to Your Honor's question, the United States Supreme Court, in a couple of opinions that we cited in our brief in Mattal and Tam, has noted that if there is a finding that a statute is content-based, restriction on speech, that essentially ends the analysis, that's dispositive. And the Supreme Court has noted that they've never even held that you need to find substantial overbreath in a content-based regulation.
Well, it's not the end of the analysis. You have to ask whether it's narrowly tailored.
Whether it's narrowly tailored, correct. But we don't necessarily need substantial overbreath if it's content-based. And
if this statute had been written in a way that required intent to either, harass, abuse, or... that conduct resulted or that effect had occurred, would it be strictly tailored to serve the goal?
I think I may have a tougher argument to make if the statute contained elements that impose a knowledge requirement on the actor in a few different aspects. One being, you have to know, first of all, that you're disseminating some type of, we can call it a private sexual image. That you had a knowledge of non-consent for dissemination. You had knowledge that there was an expectation of privacy. And then again, coupled with some type of criminal intent here and or causation. Whether or not that becomes the least restrictive means, I think, is still unknown. The United States Supreme Court has highlighted that civil remedies have long been the preferred method to address sort of these types of issues.
Right, but we have case law upholding the harassment statute, harassment by mail, in Minnesota. And in those cases, we said, well, yes, these are First Amendment communications, but these sort of criminal consequences are okay because there's a malicious intent requirement. For example, the communication will frighten, threaten, oppress, persecute, intimidate. So if you've got that sort of communication, the courts seem to say there's a First Amendment infringement, but it's tolerable because what you're trying to prevent warrants the infringement.
Correct.
So if this statute were written in a way where the conduct was strictly tied to the goal, which is to prevent that sort of harassment, abuse, oppression, intimidation, would it survive strict scrutiny?
I may still be here arguing, Your Honor, that it wouldn't, because we don't know that it still is the least restrictive means to
accomplish. You would say no criminal consequence can be imposed. It has to be a civil consequence.
Correct, because we're just in the area of protected free speech. Unless you're dealing with specifically explicit obscenity that's been set out by the United States Supreme Court in Miller, if that's the focus of the speech, the dissemination, the media, but if it's not, then
and that's covered by a different statute in Minnesota?
Yeah, we do have distribution of obscenity. And I would like to just quickly point out that there is sort of a companion statute to 617.261, which is at 604.31, we did discuss in the brief, that provides civil remedies for these situations. Interestingly enough, that requires a knowledge or has a knowledge requirement in the civil statute. And respondent hasn't advanced any arguments, any supported arguments for why the civil remedies just are insufficient in this case. And that's the government's burden to advance if it's going to make laws that touch on First Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both sides for your briefing. It's a very complicated issue, and appreciate the court does the effort you've put into giving us information we need to make an informed decision. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within the statutory time frame that's required. Thank you. We're going to take a moment to reconstitute the panel before the next case.